Copyright Forum of Christian Leaders. The contents contained on this website are solely for your own individual, non-commercial, and informational use. Any other use is strictly prohibited without our express prior written consent. See the full copyright disclosure at focalonline.org.
We talked about the six things that make up development. You know, we all know what those are now. It's fundraising and recruitment and retention and public relations and database management and strategic planning and organization, but there are six steps in the developmental process. And I want to talk about them generally, and then I want to come back, and we're going to talk about some of them more specifically a little bit later, but there's one that I really want to talk about, and that's the third step, and that becomes particularly relevant to the diagram that we just completed. So the first step in the developmental process is really identification. We call it identifying people that we would like to build a relationship with. And it, you know, there are all kinds of people out there that might have an interest in what it is that we're doing. And just remember, you know, when it comes to identifying people, that means writing their names down somewhere. I mean, in other words, a prospect's not a prospect until you have the name and address somewhere. And that's really pretty important. And so, you know, so much of what it is that we do is just, you know, name acquisition or trying to get people to identify themselves as having an interest in what it is that we're doing. And so if you're having an event or something happens, you have something to offer. For example, I call it the irresistible offer, that you have something that you've produced that basically someone who might have an interest in what it is that you're doing would want to read. And so we'd love to send it to you. It's just absolutely free. Just give us your name and address, and we'll send it to you in the mail. But essentially, we need to get ways or to discover ways to be able to identify people who have essentially, you know, qualified themselves as having a level of interest in what it is you're doing just by their response to an appeal that you've provided for them. Number two is qualification. And if you think about the again, think about the analogy of falling in love, and essentially, you know, this is essentially what happened. You know, you identified someone that you thought would be interesting, and you kind of wanted to, you know, go out and kind of evaluate whether or not this was the person that you might want to consider spending your life with or whatever the case might be. And then you kind of went through a qualification process. Sue was pretty funny. She was a little older when we got married, and we were both a little older when we got married. And so she kind of had her mindset on what it is she was looking for. And she was a psychologist, which kind of created an interesting set of scenarios for us, because she was kind of looking for somebody that was psychologically stable. And she had to actually, this was not one of her qualifications, but it was really kind of a fun thing to do. She asked me, she would administer certain tools to her clients. There's one called the MMPI, which is the Minnesota Multiphasic Inventory, which is basically how they determine whether or not a person's got psychotic. Then there's the Rorschach, you know, the little ink blots that you're supposed to try to interpret. Then there's an intelligence test, and one date I took all of those tests. And this is, we're pretty further along. I think we maybe already had the we conversation, and this was kind of like the last test to see if the guy's really crazy or not or whatever. So it was pretty funny, but that wasn't one of her qualifications. But she did have some things that she really wanted. Number one was she wanted a guy that could process. Now that's really pretty interesting, because that's a psychological word, processing. You know, I'm kind of a closure guy. I mean, I go into all kinds of situations, and I find myself, you know, finding messes in organizations, and I kind of eventually will tell them, you know, you just probably need to stop that, kind of wrap it up, put it under the tree or whatever, but you don't want to go there anymore. And so my whole focus of life is kind of, you know, dealing with things, you know, closing them up, moving forward. Sue believes in processing, which essentially means that we never end an argument. Okay, we may disagree on things, and we'll talk about it. And I will periodically come and say, you know, 20 years later, well, maybe we ought to just wrap this baby up and go on. And her answer would be, no, we're making such great progress through process. I just think that was somewhat funny because I'm just not used to processing things. And we just kind of constantly kind of process things. And I've actually discovered that I really like the process. So that was one thing that she was looking for. She was looking for a guy that cooked because she didn't like to cook. And so I love to cook. And I've traveled many times, about 150 to 160 days a year. And she's, you know, it's probably a little bit of an exaggeration, but she probably has cooked 10 meals in all the years we've been married. I'd come home on a Saturday and I'd make them up and I'd put them into a Ziploc bag and I'd put them in the freezer and say, you know, 30 seconds or 60 seconds at, you know, whatever, at high. And so she's got her meals for the whole week. And she just said, this is really, really great. She just likes that. So that worked out pretty well for us. But anyway, she had these qualifications. And she said she would have probably given, and she wanted somebody, obviously, that loved the Lord and is really committed to serving the Lord, because that was probably at the top of her list. And then all the other things were just kind of add-ons. But if I could get somebody that had all these qualities, this would be, like, really pretty cool. And it's kind of worked out pretty well, obviously, for us. So we qualify, and we all do it. And there's a variety of ways in which we do it developmentally. We have a system that on qualification that is really pretty easy in terms of your database, because we think that everybody on your database, and many of you have really large databases and some of you have rather small databases, but here's one way that we qualify people, because we believe that every person on your database is going to fall in one of three broad categories. And understanding that's really pretty important to the developmental process. So the first category that we identify is what we call a nuclear prospect. And a nuclear prospect on our database is someone who benefits directly from the services we provide. And so, you know, if you're a school, obviously your students benefit directly. Your alumni have benefited directly from the services you provide. And a lot of the people that work with you, you know, have benefited directly from the services you provide. They have a volunteer, a faculty member, a staff member, whatever the case might be. All the people that are part of, you know, kind of the family, and when you get them together, you kind of talk about your ministry family. This is, you know, we're all together. This is what we all, you know, essentially believe in and so forth. So we have nuclear prospects, and so there's a good percentage of our databases that, you know, include nuclear names. And then you have what I call affinity prospects. And an affinity prospect is someone who benefits indirectly from the services you provide. And that's a pretty wide group of people. It might be extended family members of people that you're serving. In other words, if you are offering some kind of a service to a client, and you know, the extended family members of that client are grateful for the fact that you were there for them, that you were present when they had a time of need, and so they have benefited indirectly from the services you provide. If you're a quote-unquote parachurch organization, like a pregnancy care center or Captain's Crusade for Christ or IFES or seminary like Gustav represents here in Warsaw, the realities are, you know, you're providing a service that oftentimes the church can't provide. So they benefit directly or indirectly. In other words, they don't have to have a pregnancy care center in their church for which they are not equipped to deal with some of the challenges that presents to a client. But Vesna has a network of pregnancy care centers in her area that basically can provide that service. So they're indirect beneficiaries. So businesses can be indirect beneficiaries. If you're providing any kind of vocational help, educational opportunities, those kinds of things, they are indirect beneficiaries of the services that you provide. In other words, you provide services that someone else doesn't have to provide by virtue of your existence. And then the last one is what I call a fringe prospect. And a fringe prospect is essentially someone who lives around you. In other words, there's what I call a geographic association. In other words, these people may not even know that you exist. But yet they hold potential as being partners with you if, in fact, they knew that you existed and were invited to participate in ways that were compatible with their interest levels. And so it could include charitable foundations, it could include corporations, businesses, you know, wealthy people that live in your community. I mean, the realities are there's all kinds of people that would fall into the fringe category. Now, there's a rule in development that goes something like this. This is an important statement, and I don't want you to miss this. First of all, I'll give you the rule, and then I'm going to talk about the application of the rule. So just listen carefully, if you would. The rule, and this is the most important rule in development. I mean, like, this is number one. If you take an exam, if you participate in our online program, for example, in the final exam, one of the last questions will be, or maybe the first question will be, what is the primary rule of development? Because this is the most important one. And the primary rule of development is the rule of linkage. The rule of linkage. And the rule of linkage, simply stated, is this. The closer someone is linked to you, see, these are the most closely linked to your organization. The closer an individual is linked to you, the greater the likelihood that they're going to support you. Now, that's not rocket science. I mean, you're saying, yeah, well, of course, that makes sense. But it plays out in a lot of very, very practical ways in the world of development. I mean, I'm going to have much more success soliciting the support of an individual that I know than an individual that I don't know well, right? I mean, you'd say, yeah, that makes total sense. I mean, if I go to somebody that doesn't have a clue who I am and why I'm there, and I ask them to make a substantial gift in the support of our organization or substantial commitment on our behalf, you know, it would be very, very easy to say, well, I don't think so. I mean, I have not lost anything in the game because I didn't know them in the first place. And so the closer the linkage, the greater the likelihood. Now, this is what I want you to remember. And this is like, at one level, it's something that you just really need to understand. There are two kinds of linkage. There's natural linkage, all right? Natural linkage. I am one of three children born to my mother and dad, okay? And my sisters, I'm sure along the way, probably wanted to deny the very fact of my existence that I came from someplace because I was born on Christmas Day. It must have been from the North Pole, you know. Did I tell you my birthday was on Christmas? I just want more birthday cards. But at the end of the day, you know, I could look at my parents along with my sisters and I could say, I'm the product of that relationship. In other words, they're my mother and dad too. See, we're naturally linked. People that are nuclear prospects are naturally linked. They're part of our family. And you use that term frequently, perhaps, when you're bringing people together. You're saying, we're having a family time together because you're a part of our ministry. We want to embrace you as members of the family. Now, there's another kind of linkage. And the other kind of linkage is what I call created linkage. Now, let me suggest that my parents adopted a child. Some of you have adopted children, perhaps. And when you take a family picture, you know, it's, you know, mom and dad and all the kids, and sometimes the family looks like, you know, black and yellow, or what is it, the red and yellow, black and white, all are precious in a sight. You may have adopted, you know, children that came from different ethnic backgrounds and whatever, but when you have the family picture, these are your children. This is my daughter, this is my son, this is my other daughter, and this is the twin from, you know, China, or whatever the case might be. But the reality is they're our family. Because of the linkage that was created through the adoptive process, we've made them a member of our family. So here's the rule, and here's the application of the rule that you really must remember. And this is like, interestingly enough, it is more profound than it sounds like, because it becomes the basis of so much of what it is that you're going to be needing to do in your organization. Wherever you don't have natural linkage, which is going to be among people that are here in these groups, and this group here, and this group here, wherever you don't have natural linkage, then you need to conceive of ways to create it. Whenever you don't have natural linkage, try to conceive of ways to create linkage. Now, let me give you an example. Churches, you know, are typically fall into the affinity category among parachurch organizations. In other words, they are indirect beneficiaries of the services you provide. So there are people within those congregations that you'd like to, you know, kind of invite into the family, and you're trying to figure out ways that, you know, you could do that. Well, let me suggest one way that you might all want to consider, and that is, why don't you just start a prayer partners network? And the prayer partners network is, and set a goal for it. I mean, we want 5,000, we want 10,000, we want 20,000 people in Serbia, Bosnia, and the neighboring countries around Serbia that were part of the old Yugoslavia. We want 10,000 people that are going to pray for us on a regular basis for this crisis that we struggle with, you know, in the world of abortion and how it's impacting our society, not just the young ladies who participate in the process, but the whole society in general in regards to what it represents in our patent disregard for human life. And so we just want you to pray for us, because we need to pray for our country, because this is a travesty, okay? So you're talking about it, and we'd like you to be one of our prayer partners. And we're praying for 10,000 people. We'd like you to be one of 10,000. We're praying for 1,000 people. We'd like you to be one of 1,000. And if you'd like to do that, just let us know. We'll send you a magnet that you can put on your refrigerator door, and it will help you to pray, you know, every day, each day, 1 to 31 every month, that will give you the opportunity to pray for us. Okay? Now, if they say yes to that, they've become a part. What we're trying to do is we're trying to create communities. You see, everybody in the world wants to be a part of a community. We all want to be a part of something else. And you know why? Because God designed us that way. He didn't give everybody all the spiritual gifts. You know, not one of us here have all of them and say, oh, well, I just got all the gifts, you know, like I'm really kind of doubly blessed or triply blessed or whatever the case might be. And you say, well, that's just not the case. You don't, and it's true. And I can do one thing and Victor can do another. And Victor and I could live apart, and we do live apart. He lives in Kiev, and I live in, you know, Indianapolis, and he's got gifts, and I've got gifts, and we could go on through life, you know, independently doing what it is that we can do really, really well. But you know something? I could maximize my ministry. I could impact my ministry if I had Victor. And so we have joined in a relationship because his gifts complement mine, and together we can do more than we could do alone. And if you get more people together and more people together and more people together, we're creating communities. And in communities, we can have a greater impact. And so what we want to do is we want to create communities. And so we're trying to figure out how we can do that. Now, it doesn't cost anything to be a prayer partners, to be a prayer partner. But let me just give you an illustration. Let's say that at the end of the year, Vesna says, we're going to send out a letter, and we're just going to really ask people to, you know, come alongside and help us, and you know, maybe make a Christmas gift to $10. I mean, let's say it's a very inconsequential gift, $5, $10. It doesn't have to be $1,000 or $100,000. But we just really want to get, you know, some of our friends to be engaged with us, you know, as we move into the next year. And so she sends out this letter. And just for the sake of illustration, let's say that she sends out 2,000 letters or 2,000 emails or whatever the case might be. But she sends out 2,000 pieces of communication, and she asks them if they would consider, you know, thank you for what it is that you do. Thank you for your interest in our organization. We'd love for you to consider partnering with us now as we move into the next new year and the challenges that it faces. And so she sends out these 2,000 letters. 1,000 of them, let's just say for the sake of illustration, go to people that are prayer partners. And the other 1,000 go to people that are on the database that we don't really know too much about, but they were on the database, so we sent them one too. Which group of people would be more likely to support the invitation? Class? The prayer partners. Why? Because we created linkage. We created linkage. And so now we're kind of embracing them into the family. And there are all kinds of ways that you can do that. We have a lot of our Christian school clients that have every one of their students sponsored by an adult member of the congregation of where that student came from. These are elementary and secondary schools. And so if you've got a little, you know, 8-year-old, and the people that they're looking for, quite frankly, are people that look like me and Sue, you know, who had children, and the children are grown up and they're gone and we don't have them anymore, and we're kind of looking for kids to love on and to be a part of our lives and so forth. And so they'll come to us and they'll say, well, Mr. and Mrs. Twombly, would you be willing to, you know, sponsor, you know, somebody here in the church, you know, and they kind of work it out with the family and negotiate. It's really a tough thing. It used to be a really easy thing to do in America, but now you have to kind of go through a lot just to make sure that everybody feels comfortable what it is you're asking them to do. But the only thing they ask us to do is this: to send them a birthday card, you know, and a Christmas card, and just to acknowledge the fact that you're praying for them, and just send them a letter of encouragement and so forth. And then the other thing they ask us to do is that when we see them on Sunday, or if we see them, you know, at church or whatever, it's just to go up to them or either call them on the phone and say, hey, listen, you know, is there, you know, how's things going and how'd you do in the test on Thursday, you know, in the math test or whatever, and just to let them know you're there. And most parents just love this because if you're a parent, if you ever had children, then the realities are, you know, that any adult that really loves the Lord and cares for the Lord and wants to love on our child, we're just thrilled for it because we know that they need that support, you know, the constant idea of, you know, it takes a village to raise a child or whatever. You know, I like the words, too bad it's been abused in certain circumstances, but the whole point is that it's true. And the other thing they ask us to do is to come to a meeting at the end of the year just so we can talk about the relationship and what it meant to us. And so we all get together, all the sponsors with their kids, and it's like a real nice dinner, and we talk about it, and then the kids talk about, well, you know, something really neat happened here and so forth, and it just kind of builds this community. And so that's another way you could build community is have sponsors. Another way you could build community, we have senior auxiliaries. You know, there are a lot of seniors that are my age that are not doing as much as I'm doing. And they're kind of looking for things to do and ways in which they can engage now in a different way in the organizations that you represent. So why not create an auxiliary, some kind of an organization? You see, what you're doing is you're not only providing an opportunity, but you're creating a community. And that's so important to your long-term success. So if you don't have natural linkage, how do you create linkage with people? And alumni associations, the way colleges have done it, and then they have regional alumni associations, in which if you live in a certain state, you can come to, you know, to meetings that take place in that state. There's all kinds of creative ideas, and you're probably going to come up with a gazillion more, but those don't cost anything. See, it didn't cost anything to offer those. I mean, these are just opportunities we'd like to make available to you. We'd like you to plug in with us, and this is a way you can do that, because otherwise they're not going to figure that out on their own. It's one of those things that I talked about. There are two assumptions that we make in ministry, and both of them are wrong. The first one is that when you say something, they get it, and the second one is that that even if they get it, they're going to expend the energy to try to figure out how to deal with it, and they're not going to do probably both. So you've got to almost think people through the process. Here are ways that you can engage and continue to be an ongoing partner with us and really meaningfully helping us to move forward what it is that God's called us to do. So qualification is like really, really important. Now, I'm going to come back to this in just a few minutes. I'm kind of bouncing around a little bit, but it all comes together in just a few seconds, so if you just bear with me. The third step in the process is cultivation. And cultivation is like courtship. Okay, so we've been talking about the analogy of love, and cultivation is like courtship. You know, we want to get to know one another. We want to begin to deepen our relationship. We want to be able to really embrace people in ways that are appropriate to their needs, and sometimes we don't know what those needs are. So I'm going to give you another diagram, and it's in your coloring book. And it looks like I'm coming to it, I'm sure. It looks like this, okay? This one here, the second from the back. I have to tell you a little bit about how this emerged because it was really pretty interesting. I had served in the development office at Grace College and Theological Seminary for about 9 years in various capacities. And then, after the ninth year, I was invited to be a member of the administration as a vice president for the institution in charge of the whole developmental arena. And so at this point in my life, I really felt that this is what God had called me to do this work. And so I really didn't know an awful lot about it, so I really wanted to learn as much as I could. But the first thing that I did was I asked for a printout, as I think I shared with you, and I came up with, you know, looking at all these names that were on a database because I was trying to figure out how I wanted to approach the challenge that was before me. Did I want to go out and get a whole lot of new names into our database? That was one thought that had been presented to me. What you need to do is you need to expand your database so that you can increase your income. That kind of made sense to me at one level. And then the other, you know, people suggested other things to me, and so I decided that before I could make an informed decision, I needed to know where people were on the database. And so I got this database, and I kind of collected information, and we identified people. We finally came up with a group of about 100 people that were very, very devoted supporters of our organization. So you could come up with the same list. You know, you could come up with people. It would be pretty easy to do for most of you. A whole list of people that were really committed, devoted, long-term, lifelong supporters to your organization that just have been there for you. And what we did is we brought our staff together, and we began to ask, what is common among all of these people? What are some of the common things that we see in all of these people? And we came up with three things that we saw. Now, it's not always going to be the same three things. And you're going to go through this process again, probably in a number of different other, at some other times in your career, and it's going to be a different group that you're going to be looking at. But I came up with three things, or we came up with three things. So here's a person in our database. And there was one thing that we came up with, which is really pretty simple, obviously, but we call it vestiture. And vestiture essentially means that they had invested something into the organization. So you, those of you that are Americans are probably more familiar with that word than perhaps others of you might be. But we talk a lot about vestiture. And vestiture essentially means that, you know, they're vested in your organization. In other words, they've got some skin in the game, so to speak, okay? Or they're not vested, they have no skin in the game at all. Does that analogy help a little bit? So we knew that they were either vested or non-vested. So that was the first thing that we wanted to know. Are they vested? In other words, they've been involved and engaged with us, or they're not vested. But over here, we knew that there were differences. And we knew that people on our database, some people were very, very committed to us. Those were the people whose names appeared among the 100 that we identified as being the people that we really, first of all, wanted to look at. So let's call those people A's. In other words, they were very well cultivated. These people, whenever we had a crisis, they were always there. And you have them in your organization. If you were facing a crisis, if something, you know, was coming down and you just knew you needed money right away, I mean, in other words, there's a bad storm and the roof blew off, and you know, you needed to get it repaired and you didn't know who to call, well, most of you would make a list of people that you would call that you have a relatively strong sense of certainty that they're going to respond affirmatively. Yes, oh yeah, I'll show you, but let me help you. It was an emergency and we can help you. Some people, you know, you think might be willing to respond. Let's call them B's. Some people you're not sure at all, but you might want to ask them if they'd respond. And there's some people that you probably wouldn't even bother to ask at all. So we have A, B, C, and D prospects. So the first thing that we did was we said, we know we have donors, we know we have people on our database that are in varying degrees of relationship with the organization. There's some that are A's, there's some that, but we didn't know why they were A's. We just knew that there were some people that had distinguished themselves, others that hadn't distinguished themselves quite as much, others that hadn't at all, and some, you know, that we just didn't know much about at all. So now we have a large group of people. We broke it down into at least three or four broad categories. The next thing we did was we discovered that there were three things that were unique to all the people that were A's. And in our case, we found out that those that were A's were faithful in attending things that we did. In other words, when we were offering opportunities, when we were, you know, doing special things at the college, when we were, you know, engaging people at different levels, you know, for things that were unique to the mission to which we'd committed ourselves, whenever the door was open, they were kind of like there. And you have people like that, that, you know, whenever you do something, you know that there's kind of be a core group of people that are going to show up because they always show up for everything because they're deeply devoted to what it is that you do. So they attended things, and it wasn't just that they came once, but they were coming on a fairly regular basis. The second thing that we noticed is that they all were involved in one way or another beyond what it is that you would realistically expect them to be involved in. In other words, they were serving on task force, they were serving on committees. They were serving, you know, as volunteers. They were always anxious to respond in any need that might come along the way that might fall into their area of ability to be able to contribute and so forth. But they were involved. And And if that would be something that you would say, yeah, that's probably true with our constituency as well, then I think you need to stop long enough to begin to ask the question, how can people be involved in my organization? I mean, that would be a good homework assignment, just to say, well, what kinds of ways could people be involved in helping us? How could a man be involved in a pregnancy care center? How could a woman be involved in how could a teenager be involved in a pregnancy care center or whatever it is that you do? How could they be involved? Make a list, and make it a long, long list, because the more the involvement opportunities, the stronger, and to the degree that people become involved in participating in them, the stronger your organization is going to be. So we noticed that all of those people were really involved. That was one of the other characteristics that was consistent with all of them. And then the last thing that we noticed among them is that they all were making contributions to us. And I say donations only because it kind of came out nice. Did you notice this? AID. It's kind of a word that you can remember. And so I didn't particularly like the word donation because I didn't want to necessarily attribute it to dollars and cents as much as I wanted to attribute it to sacrifice. In other words, people can make donations that not necessarily reflected in money, but in the sacrifice of doing something that goes far above and beyond what it is that you would realistically expect them to do. But what we did discover, that if they did all three, they equaled an A. If they've done two of the three, they equal a B. If they'd done one of the three, they'd equal a C. And if they've done none of the three, they equal a D. So now we went through our database. Now we have, 40,000 people on our database. And we began this excruciating process, and it took us almost a year and a half to get it done, where we basically went through everybody that we knew on the database, and we qualified them on the basis of, number one, their linkage to the institution, and number two, their level of cultivation. So we would have a group of people, if we were printing out a report, of all of our nuclear Bs. See, most of your nuclear people are going to be A's to begin with, just because of the nature of what it is that they do. But you have a lot of Bs, you have a lot of Cs, you have a lot of Ds. We had affinity, A, B, Cs, and Ds. We had fringe, A, B, Cs, and Ds. And so now, rather than just mail to everybody on our mailing list, we're being very, very selective into whom we're mailing based upon what we know about them that we didn't know before. The average direct response marketing piece, and direct response marketing is almost moving away from being a major player in the world of development these days. It's not necessarily ever going to go away. That direct response marketing means simply you're sending direct mail to people. And now there are other ways to communicate that may not be as effective, but they're certainly less expensive. And so we've got to figure out how to use the new tools like email blasts and text messaging and so forth. There's a whole new arena of opportunities out there that we need to figure out how to leverage in order to be able to accomplish the same thing that we were doing for years just through direct mail. But on direct mail, the average response to a direct mail piece is less than 3%, which means that if you sent out 1,000 letters, you might get, three returns? I mean, not that many. It's just essentially it's not that great. And so I told organizations, I said, well, first of all, are you satisfied with that? Are you satisfied with a 3% response? Would you be more satisfied with a 4% response? I said, oh, of course we'd be satisfied with a 4%. What about a 5%? Well, yeah, we'd be really happy with that. But are you still happy with 5%? Stop and think about that. That's 95% of the people that you wrote to could care less about what it is you're going to do to the point where they would make a commitment on your behalf. So essentially, I can save you a lot of money. Don't even bother to send them in the first place because they're not going to answer. And what it really reflects is the fact that the majority of your database is probably C or D, which means that you haven't done anything with them from the moment you put them into the database other than send them mail and asking them for money. And so we just figured, there's a certain amount of stuff that you just probably ought not ever to do. So I always tell people that I really, one of my weaknesses, and it's, I'm not being facetious, but I just really don't, I can hardly handle rejection. I mean, I should grow out of something, I mean, good night, I'm 70 years old, you think I'd get over it, but when somebody says something, like, you're not doing this, and I'm thinking, oh, I'm just worthless. I mean, I'm just going to go shoot myself, because what in the world am I occupying space on this planet when I didn't do that, for crying out loud? And or somebody will say, I mean, honestly, it's not quite that bad, but I really take it personally, and it really is just hard on me. And here you say, well, Jerry, you've been in this profession for 40-some years, and you're still alive, so that must mean something. But, you know, essentially what it means is that I learned something, and that is that I wasn't going to spend too much time talking about, you know, people asking money for people that were C's and D's. That was the first thing that I learned. Now, that doesn't mean that we didn't do something with them. We did a lot of things with them, but it was very strategic rather than just kind of hit and miss, which most of development is. It's kind of a hit and miss thing, and kind of hoping we're going to hit the target more than we don't. Now, in this case, I knew that there was at least a 60% likelihood. See, the likelihood percentages are really pretty interesting. There's less than a 10% likelihood that anybody that's a D prospect is going to do anything. There's about a 30% likelihood that a C prospect might, a 60% likelihood that a B prospect might, and about a 90% likelihood that an A prospect might respond to you. So I just kind of figured that I'm going to spend a lot of my time up here. And if somebody didn't respond to me, then I'm not going to take it quite so hard, because they're going to be at least nice to me because of the nature of the relationship that we had. But I was even able to figure out ways to increase the likelihood only by virtue of the fact by providing more than one opportunity. Usually in the world of philanthropy, we basically say, you know, would you consider a gift of $50? Or would you consider a gift? Well, really, if you're just looking at percentages alone, you got a 50-50 chance that somebody's going to say yes or no to you. But the problem is, you know, in the world of development, no is really not a good answer. It's not a good answer because you don't get what you want. It's more significant than that, because every time someone says no, the door closes a little bit more. And there does come a point in time when the door is closed and you can't get it open again. But you know what I've learned over the course of, you know, all these years of doing this is that people really don't find a lot of satisfaction in saying no. They really don't. Most people really do want to say yes, but we don't give them enough opportunities to say yes. And so when I talk to people, I just want to say something like this. If I'm talking to someone and, you know, I know you just love this organization. We so appreciate all the things that you've done for us. Here we are moving into a new stage of our growth and development, and sure love to have you get involved. And just let me tell you our vision and where it is that we're going, and just kind of articulate the vision. And then say, you know, we just love to have you engaged, and I'd like to just share with you five or six things that we'd like you to pray about and consider about becoming involved in our work. And then give them at least one or two things that they could say yes to. And it may be, you know, I'll be one of your prayer partners, or I'd like to receive your VIP newsletter that you send once a month, you know, which is just basically an update of where you are in relationship to your goals, and, you know, not a long, you know, six-page, you know, email, but, you know, two or three paragraphs that are really and concisely done that really communicate in capsulized ways, you know, the essence of who it is we are, what it is we're doing, where it is that we're going, just to keep them in touch. I mean, that's something that almost anybody could say yes to. And then give them other opportunities that might be more substantive, but at least give them more opportunities to say yes. So this model really helped us. And so, you know, when it came to our development strategy as an organization, we went through the process of ABCDs, nuclears, and this one is really not very many, but sometimes you'll find one or two that are A's and that really are extremely engaged. And then we had ABCD affinities, we had ABCD fringes. Now let me just say that our strategy was not to move fringes to affinity and affinity to nuclear. In other words, a fringe prospect, a corporation, for example, might remain a fringe prospect. But if they became a member of your board, then all of a sudden they can become a nuclear prospect and so forth. But it's okay to be a fringe prospect. It's okay to be an affinity prospect. So essentially what our goal was, and rather than having one development program, during that era in time, which was about 1986 or so, during that period of time, our goal was that we had a team of people working, all volunteers, and one, you know, group of volunteers, you know, basically were just focused on D prospects to make them C prospects. How would you do that? Get them to come to something. So what kind of things are we going to do? We're going to provide all kinds of opportunities, one of which we feel like they might be interested in, if in fact, you know, they have an interest. And most of them would have an interest only by virtue of the fact that they're on our mailing list in the first place. They had to get there because of some level of association with us. And if they don't ever respond, then we do a lot of purging, or we consider purging, but only after we've made an effort, a genuine effort, to try to engage them in ways compatible to their interests. And so the people working with C's, we're just trying to get our C's up to B's. And the people that are working with B's, we're just trying to get our B's up to A's. And the people that are working with A's, we're just, you know, cultivating. It was kind of that other side of the attitude continuum where we're seeking to really strengthen the relationship, to support them, to care for them, to let them know how much we appreciate. And we did the same thing here and the same thing here. And essentially what happened over a four-year period of time, when we started this, we were generating an income of about $475,000 a year. 4 years later, we were averaging about $2.5 million a year. But the thing that happened, and this is the thing that you need to remember, we increased from $475,000 to $2.5 million a year. That was back when that was a lot of money, back in the early 80s or the mid-80s. But we did it, practically speaking, without an appreciable increase in the size of the database. That's the point you need to remember. That we didn't add to our database. We just improved the health of our database by doing proactively things that we knew needed to be done, or at least intuitively knew we needed to do. And the word of encouragement there for all of you is this: you probably have a database that's sufficient to meet your immediate needs right now. In other words, don't go out and just get a whole bunch of new ones, because all you're going to do is you're going to do the same thing to the new ones that you've done with the old ones, which is essentially ignore them in the kinds of ways that they, you know, in providing the attention that they need in order to grow in their relationship with you, just like we need to grow in our relationships, you know, in marriage and in falling in love. So this is like really, really important stuff. Now, if we go back here where we started, AID, now you know what that means. See, during this period of cultivation, or, you know, to the point where we are getting people, hopefully they'll become lifelong supporters to us, we're cultivating that relationship using this AID acronym. We're trying to get them to come to things. We want to get them involved. We want to get them to, you know, consider making a sacrifice in some way that's going to enable us to further the cause. Don't think about money. Think about sacrifice. People going out of their way to do something that is not going to be uncomfortable with them, but something that enables them to participate with us in helping us to move forward. Now, the other acronym is CIA, and you see that on your... Now, CIA... It sounds bad. It's like, but I go to Russia. I actually change it when I teach seminars in Russia. I go to KGB. and if you have one in, you know, your country, I'll work on it or whatever. I just want people to remember it. And CIA, C stands for communication. The biggest problem that causes attrition among devoted supporters, or people who have expressed their support by giving to you, is that they feel that once they gave, the communication channels kind of slowed down or closed down. The biggest reason why divorces occur at the rate that they do in the world in which we live is that we don't talk anymore to one another like we used to when we were courting. We don't sit as long and listen and show interest in what our spouse is talking about, because we know that if she stops, we can kind of go on and do something that we want to do rather than focus our attention on our spouse. Communication is one of the largest, most significant reasons why we lose people. We just fail to communicate with them in meaningful ways to share with them how much we care for them. I stands for involvement. That's the other problem. You know, Sue and I did everything together when we were courting, but we still do a lot of things together, you know, probably more than the average couple, quite frankly. But the realities are, that's not always true, is it? That we don't get involved with one another. We don't live each other's lives. We don't try to move into their life and vice versa. But we want that to be a part of our lives because we know how important it is. And you can understand that. And then A is appreciation. You know, we just expressing kind ways to appreciate someone. I was going to be gone for 10 days. I'm trying to get a little pat on the back here on this one. I really am not, but I was gone for 10 days. I left, I don't know, last week sometime. And Sue, she kind of likes sweets. So I went out and bought some candy, and I had 10 little Ziploc bags, and I just put like 3 or 4 pieces of candy and a couple of jelly beans in, and a note, and I wrote up 10 different notes, and all of them told her how much I loved her. And every day I send her a text message and I tell her where the next bag is. She didn't know. The first 3, she's saying, "What are you doing?" And I says, yesterday I says, "Look in the oatmeal box in the pantry." And there in the oatmeal box in the pantry, she opens it up and there's candy in this little Ziploc bag. But it, you know, just expressing, you know, simple ways of appreciation. It doesn't have to be complex and it doesn't have to be expensive. It's the fact that you cared enough to do it. And that's the way we sustain relationships. So all of these things go together. We went through this one. This is your relational continuum. And we went through the courtship continuum, the courtship process, which is the cultivation one. All right, the next one is solicitation. I don't even like the word. I don't know what the... I guess probably... When I think of solicitation, I think of somebody on a street corner or something, I guess, that doesn't communicate to me what it is I want to communicate. What I'm essentially saying is that there's some point in time that we need to ask people. We need to, you know, say we would, and ask them something that basically they're going to say yes or no to. In other words, that's the rational component of the developmental process, where it's emotional, you know, and rational, and when people say yes or no to something, they're making a decision, and you want them to make a decision. And so, you know, we need to ask people, and we're going to talk about ways to do that, you know, a little bit more specifically tomorrow in one of the other pages on your coloring book there, but let me just talk about some things that I've learned in that area that may be of value to you, and I have to relate to a lot of the things that, you know, I've experienced because I can tell the stories more factually and probably with a little bit more passion. When I first started in this profession, somebody sent me to somebody, I guess it was my president, told me to go to the president of a large corporation in our company, and he says, "You might want to suggest that he consider a contribution of $100,000 or more." Now, you have to understand, I'm kind of young. This is like I had done a lot of things, but this was like the first time anybody had said, you know, "Why don't you go ask this guy for $100,000? And so I, you know, dutifully responded. I went to the, called the guy on the phone, said, you know, "Could we meet for lunch?" And he says, "Sure, I'd love to do that." So I pick him up and we go to a restaurant. We're sitting down. And we sit down in the restaurant and it's kind of an awkward situation. You've all been there because you know that, you know, this is probably important, and if he got involved at this level, that would be, you know, really, really nice, and it would enable us to do some things that otherwise we might not be able to do. But I began talking about his family, because I knew some of his kids, and I talked about the business, how's the business going, and he was telling me about his business, and, you know, the meal comes, and we're eating, and he just built a new house. "Well, how's the house going?" "Oh, it's really great. You need to come down and take a look at it, you know." And before I knew it, you know, he says, "Well, I need to get back to the office." And I was just in my comfort zone talking about the things that I really felt comfortable with. I didn't want to kind of move out of my comfort zone. And I remember dropping him off at his office and coming back and saying, "I don't know if I should be in this profession," because I couldn't even ask that guy for anything. And I just remember going back to my office, and I sat down and I said, I've got to figure out a way that's going to be comfortable for me, because I need crutches. And I'm here to say that most of you need crutches. You need some assistance. You need a little bit of help to make it a little bit easier. You know, you need something that's going to work for you. And all of us are a little bit differently, but I know I needed crutches. And so my crutch ended up being creating a little personalized proposal. And let me kind of explain what the personalized proposal looked like. And I sat down and I really worked on this, and we've since sophisticated it, and I can send you samples, and but I'll give you the outline of what this proposal included. You know, first of all, I talked about the mission of our school. Now, this is a college, and I'm just talking about our mission. And you might write down the mission statement, but what I tried to, you know, say something, you know, that basically, you know, some of the things that we're doing, and then tried to tie in that into the mission statement, and this is the mission that we're trying to. I just really wanted to know why we existed, and this is the kind of the basis of the essence of who it is we are as an organization. So I talked a little bit about mission. I'll tell you the percentages of the report and how much should be in each category in just a few minutes, so just kind of hang with me a little bit. The second part of this little proposal, and it's about 3 pages long, usually no more than three, usually about 2.5. The second page was, or the second thing that I wanted to mention was just our history. You know, where we've come from. You see, your organization is on a continuum, somewhere between when it started and when it's going to end. So it's somewhere on a continuum. And what you need to do in development is you need to contextualize. You need to contextualize. You need to say, you know, here's where we've come from, here's where we're going, here's where we are now. They need to see where they are on that continuum, where you are in that continuum. And the older you are, interestingly enough, the more credible you become. And that's not hard to figure out, because we all know that, don't we? So you're listening to me because I'm old. You're just being polite, and you're saying, okay, I'll listen to him because he's just old and he might know something. But obviously, and I'm being a bit facetious, but you know that that's true, don't you? Is that you go to I love going down the streets of London and going past the haberdashery, and they'll say, since, 1452, this guy's been making hats, you know. Well, you figure that anybody that's been making hats since 1452 must know how to make hats. So there's a little bit more credibility going to this store than the guy that opened up last week, you know, with some straw. So a little bit about history. And you can do it in a timeline. There's all kinds of creative ways that you could do it. And it's kind of interesting when it comes to history, because you can say, well, this was phase one and this was phase two, but at the time you were doing them, you had no idea what phase one was. But now you look back and say, well, that was phase one. And you just had a new phase added when you went to speak at a conference and saying, we want to have, you know, every, you know, pregnancy care centers in all of the old Yugoslavian empire. And okay, well, we just went to phase two. We're going to grow this organization. You know, and so that's phase two. That's where we are now. And there's probably a phase three on your vision, and probably a phase four. But you know what that is. And despite the fact that you didn't know it at the time, you can see distinctive marks that were unique to our beginnings and at various stages in our development. So we just talk about history. Now, the next and the third step in this model is vision. Now, this is where, and literally, if we're talking about percentages early on, it probably would be 5% of the total of what it is that you're going to do is going to be devoted to talking about your mission statement. That's just getting it out there, letting people know why you exist. Only about 10, no more than 12% on your history. Figure out ways that you can concisely capsulize, you know, the years of your history in ways that basically people can relate to. You don't have to tell them, you know, on such and such a day, William Wilberforce, you know, came out of Parliament, and then you're kind of building this long history that led up to something that basically is important to you. Don't do that. Just capsulize your history in ways that shows that you have a history and you've made progress. The third one is vision, and that should represent as much as 40, maybe even 50% of this proposal that you're going to prepare and personalize for this individual. Because vision, as we pointed out, is what it is that captures the imagination of people. We want to let them know that we have a vision for the future. And most organizations don't have that vision. You know, if you ask the average organization, ask your director, what's the vision of your organization? And you might find them stuttering a bit. You know, well, you know, it's to reach people for Jesus, you know. Well, that's great, and I'm all for that, but, you know, what's your vision? Well, to do it a lot of times, you know, so that we really have great success. Well, what does that look like? Well, I'm not sure I know what it looks like. It means kind of coming to the Lord. Well, is that enough? I mean, I'm not trying to be facetious, but the point is that most of us, you know, have never articulated that. And many of you have told me that already, you know, since our time together yesterday. So what's the vision? I've got my Bulgarian buddies over there. I had yesterday talking to Tony and Andrew, and they said, well, you know, would you come to Bulgaria? I said, I'd love to come to Bulgaria. First of all, I'd just love to go see those guys because I really like those guys. But I love those guys so much because they've got a passion. I says, you know, if we really want to be serious, you know, let's take on a project. Like, in 10 years, let's see that we can, you know, we're going to just pray for a real revival in Bulgaria. You know, let's put a plan in place to do that. You know, that's a pretty compelling vision. I want to be a part of that. I mean, I'm standing in line for opportunities like that. I mean, pick me. I want to come. You know, I want to come and be a part of helping to be something that's going to enable, you know, a whole nation to be exposed to the heart of God in ways that, you know, we can do if, in fact, we were to plan it. But the realities are we don't talk about the vision. We talk about our needs so much that basically everybody kind of figures that their only vision is ending the year in the black. We have a vision. We have a great vision for our organization. What is it? Ending the year in the black. Why? Because we can do it again next year. Okay? That's more close to home than perhaps some of you want to go, but I think that's true. Okay, so vision. Then that's followed by strategic plan. In other words, we have a vision. That's great. I'm glad you have a vision. You know, what's your plan? We've got a plan. We've got a plan, and you can't articulate that plan. It needs about 20% of the time. You can talk about it. We have a plan. Usually in these proposals, oftentimes we'll have appendices at the end of it, you know, and we just say, if you would like to see the full plan, you know, we've included it there. Or if you'd like to see a summary of the plan, if you'd like to see the full plan, just let us know. We'll send it to you. But they need to know that you have a plan. I mean, it's not just heartburn from something that, you know, caused you some gastronomic distress that you ate the night before, and this is the vision that occurred while you were whining about how badly you felt, and we come back and we try to sell it to somebody, and as ludicrous as that sounds, I've heard stories that are very, very similar to that. You know, the founder had a vision last night, and tomorrow we're selling it. But he may have another one tomorrow that says that wasn't the real vision. This is the, you know, the appendix to the new vision and so forth. That sounds very pejorative, and I'm sorry. I'm not trying to be mean. But I am saying, you know, that a lot of those things do happen. All right, so now we have the vision. And then finally, it's the ask. What are we asking them to do? And usually we have an opportunity page that's at the back. It's the next page that follows. And the opportunity page basically says, here are some ways that you can be involved, one of which means making a contribution. But there are 7, 8, or 8 other ways that in which you can participate. The issue is you're always looking for something that someone can say yes to. Because if they walk out saying nothing, that's no. And if they say no, that's no. But in both cases, the doors are closing and the opportunity is being lost. Now, so I wrote this down. The first thing I did was I wrote it down. The second thing I did was I gave it to a creative writer because I'm not really a great creative writer. And so I gave it to somebody. And I said, would you take a look at this and see if you can kind of massage it a little bit? The problem with working with a creative writer is some of them are really, really creative. And they kind of rewrite the whole thing, and it's not at all what you wanted to say. But I think you would understand that and recognize that. But getting someone, a professional, a journalist, somebody that's a really good editor that basically can understand the nuances of grammar and so forth, and all the things that are, you know, really important to know, and just in a way that really looks professional. So that was the second thing. And the third thing that I did was, I gave it to a graphic design person. And I said, and this is the one thing you have to say to a graphic design person, and they all get it immediately. And that is, I gave them this sheet of paper, and I said, I want you to, you know, design this paper so that it screams out to anybody that sees it, read me, read me, read me, read me, read me. And if you give somebody that challenge, a good graphic designer that challenge, believe me, they're going to do a great job. And they did do a great job. And have them put it into a format, not like Adobe or some of these things that you don't have the program for, but put it into a program that you can replicate. Because what we did is we came up with a lovely cover page that was really relevant to the project. And then on the bottom of that cover color, that page, which was in full color, we would print them all up, you know, professionally. And on the bottom, we would allow space for this proposal prepared personally for, and then we would just type in the name of the individual. And there was one place in the proposal where we put the name on the opportunity page where we put the name and the address of the individual in there so that they didn't have to fill it out because we had that information already. So there's two places where we did replace, you know, cut and replace. And we got it back. Now let me tell you the difference that that happened. I did that, and then finally I called my friend, you know, who was the president who was we wanted to give $100,000 to. And I think he kind of, he was really a nice guy and he really did like me. And so I call him up again. I says, hey, Dane, what's the chances of having lunch together? He says, yeah, I'd like to do that. And so we go out to lunch. And the first thing that I do, I sit down at the table. And the first thing that I do, I have two of these with me. This is my proposal. Okay, I have two. I have one for him. It has both of them have his name on it. So I have, I sit down at the table. The first thing I do is I just set that next to my place. Now I have discovered after 40 some years of doing this that most people can read upside down. they just can read upside down. They just kind of like know that, oh. And you know what? I talked about his wife, I talked about his family, I talked about his new house. But that's still sitting there. I never said a word about it. Still sitting there. And finally, we order dessert, and the waitress comes and collects the plates, and as we're waiting for dessert and she's pouring coffee, I said, Dane, I've got something I'd like to share with you. I gave his copy. I took mine. Now, with this in my hand, I don't feel naked. This is my security blanket. This is my crutch. I mean, I've got this in my hand, and if I can never do anything else, at least I can read it. You know, but the reality is I have this in my hand. I says, Dan, I'd just like to share with you a few things and just take a few minutes to do that. But I opened it up and we get to the first page. I talk about our mission and our vision. You know, here's where it is we're going. And we're so excited about this. We really think that this is going to make a huge difference in our community. It's going to be great for our college. It's going to be great for our alumni. It's going to be great for the country. And we've got a great vision. We've got power behind it. And he's like really getting excited. He's asking questions about it. He says, here's our plan. This guy's total business. He's total, you know, numbers, you know, do this, do that, and do the other thing. I mean, this guy is, you know, the number one analyst. It's probably the large orthopedic manufacturer in America. This guy's the president and the founder of it. And so he looks at that and he says, we just would like to have you involved in this. If you flick over to the last page, you know, here's some opportunities we'd like you to consider. And you know what? We had a little giving chart which started with $500,000 at the top. Went down to, you know, we're going to need some gifts this size, and I don't know if that's something you'd be interested in, but and we had some corporate opportunities, and we had listed those, and so he gives $500,000, and I was going to only ask him for $100,000. But you know something? It was because we did this, and I would just encourage you, I don't care how long, it would be a rare day that I would go to anyone and ask them for anything without something like that in my hand, because somebody that could give $500,000, you'd say, well, they deserve it. So does somebody that can give $10,000. They deserve it too. And somebody that can give $25,000, they deserve it too. And that doesn't take much time, but it's something that we all should consider doing. So, the fifth step in the process, identify, qualify, cultivate, solicit, sustain. And actually, it's a five-step process because that's the last one. But and essentially, that's the side past the diamond on the attitude continuum. Sustaining their involvement, keeping them engaged. We know how to do that. So this is, you know, this is CIA, and this is AID. Okay, so it's a five-step development process. I I have numbers for everything and I can never get them straight. Okay? So does that help? Go home. You know, one of the things that I really encourage you to do, and these, I will try to make a list of all the things that I want you to do when you go home, okay? But one of the things that I'd like you to do when you go home is to write a proposal and send it to me. I will critique it. I'll be really kind and nice to you. But if you, let me look at it. You know, let me give you some suggestions. You might want to put some pictures. You may want to put a graph in it. Anything that's going to basically, you know, kind of make it stand out and scream out, read me, read me, read me. Okay, that's what you want. And personalize it. And then start sharing it with people. And, you know, one of the things you might want to do is just, you know, vet it with some of your friends. You know, just take them out and say, hey, listen, this is a new proposal that we've created. I'd like you to just evaluate it and assess it. Is there something that it's missing? That's a whole other thing, is a story that's yet to be told.
Yes. How would you thank people?
Well, it really depends, you know, on, I mean, obviously I would thank them. Usually we try to bring, you know, all of the people that support a project together, you know, have some kind of a special open house just for all of our donors, regardless of what size they, of their gift. So the $500,000 donor sitting next to a guy that gave $100, that's fine, that's great. I mean, I don't think you should necessarily show a special favor to anyone. I mean, there's a certain sense in which you obviously can express appreciation. I mean, somebody that makes a $500,000 gift is something that, you know, you obviously want to recognize. I think, you know who was really, really good at that is Paul Eshelman. And I don't know if you know Paul, but Paul was kind of the chairman and the president of the Jesus Film Project for Campus Crusade for Christ. And basically when we were doing the, you know, all the raising the money for Campus Crusade for Christ, the translations and so forth, it might cost us like $50,000 or $75,000 to translate it into a certain language. And so many times a donor would say, well, I want to do that. I want to pay for doing it in, you know, Mongolia or China or someplace. And one of the things Paul did, and I think, you know, it's just, I mean, there were a number of things. It wasn't just this, but one of the things that he would do with some of those larger donors is that he says, we're going to just, you know, I'd like you to join me. We're going to go to Mongolia for the premiere showing. I'd love to have you come with me. And so he'd go with them, and they'd show the Jesus film and Mongolian. This poor guy is just seeing these, you know, tens of hundreds of people that they're coming to know Christ and just responding in faith. And on the way back, Paul says, well, we've got Nepal next in line. And these guys are just throwing money at the project because they just want to be involved in something that's making such a huge difference. So I think there's probably ways that are appropriate that would be unique for and be realistically not necessarily expected, but understood by your other donors. You know, this guy that paid $75,000 to, you know, translate it into to Mongolian, you know, probably deserved the opportunity to be able to go and see what his donation had contributed, practically speaking, you know, in the lives of the people that saw the film. So anyway, think about thanking. How can you thank people? My mother had a, this is kind of a interesting thing. My mom had a requirement of my sisters and I. When people did something nice to us, we had to thank them three times. Not once, three times. And it was really annoying because, well, it wasn't, I mean, the first two were like really, really easy. The first one is thank you. I mean, that was kind of like really easy. The second one might be sending a note saying thank you. And that wasn't all that hard. But the third one was really hard because we had to do something creative to say thank you. And she'd check it. I mean, you know, she'd be sitting there checking it off. Okay, well, you got two and you need to get this one done. You need to get it done by tomorrow afternoon or whatever the case might be. And so I'm like really searching for things. You know, how can I show, you know, I might, you know, bake them cookies and take them to church on Sunday and say, here's some cookies that I baked to thank you or whatever. I mean, there's all kinds of things that we did. But it was really very good for me to do that because I recommend to our clients, you know, thank people three times. Because the first time they didn't hear you in the first place, or they would have expected to, of course, say thank you. But the second one they might not have expected, or at least a personal note from the president or a personal call from the president or something that says, you know, we're really grateful for this. I know you made a gift, and I just really want to say thank you. But the third one is the really one that's going to make the difference, and it's the one they'll always remember.